general relativity. So you've learned about Einstein's theory of gravity. And you'll have done probably a few things with Neil, looking at where you can apply the gravity. But since the focus of his course was actually communicating what Einstein's relativity was, you won't have done them in any sort of great detail. I mean, I think you did a little bit of an introduction to cosmology. So what, anything on black holes? Yeah, so you did like the basic black hole solution and looked at a few things about that. Yep, okay. Extra dimensions? Nope. I don't know, black hole thermodynamics? Nope. Perturbation theory? Nope. Okay. Right. So those will be some of the things, at least, that we'll be taking a bit of a look at. But first of all, I want to just do what you might call revision, in the sense that although I gather Neil did a reasonably mathematical introduction to relativity, it's often useful to go over these things again, mainly because if you've got the basics, you know, well and truly under your belt, you actually find some of these more advanced concepts a lot easier to tackle. So just for today, at least, and maybe even tomorrow as well, we'll be going back over some of the things that you did with Neil. Hopefully it'll refresh your memory, and maybe, I'm not entirely sure precisely what his angle was, but you know, it may actually be just slightly different in terms of the approach. And in particular, when looking at extra dimensions, having some of this background, having accumulated that and got some fluency with it, it's quite useful, okay? So, general relativity is essentially applied differential geometry. There's a huge amount of mathematics in it. And you can choose to develop the subject either by looking at the physics or by, you know, taking quite a differential geometric approach. So I'm not a pure mathematician, so I'm not going to be very careful with, you know, in terms of doing, you know, really rigorous mathematics here. But I'll kind of try and steer a middle ground where I'm using some of the terminology. So if people are interested, you know, they can go up and check in more detail on some of these issues. But also, anyway, you can stop me. If you have questions, please do stop me. It's better if I've kind of assumed something that you don't know, or I've been a bit glib about something, it's better that we kind of get these things sorted in real time rather than it running on, okay? So I'll start off by just saying a few conventions, because, you know, like with many subjects, you do have choices of conventions, and these can change signs, and signs can be quite important in physics. So, I'm one of these people who, I think I'm in a minority, where I take my metric signature to be lots of minuses. So, in other words, when we're looking at distances in space-time, for me, a time-like distance is a positive distance, and space-like distance is a negative. I also have that if we allow this, is more conventional. I think there's still one or two people who use something different. In the definition of the Riemann tensor, this is in the ordering of the indices. So D is the last index, and it is grad C of the gamma with the D in it, okay? And in taking the Ricci tensor, it's first and third. So that's just to be clear, because I know that there are, although this part of it at least is very much the dominant convention, there's probably one or two older textbooks out there that have something slightly different. I will set also H bar and C to be 1. Setting C equals 1 is reasonably obvious. We're doing relativity, and some of the time I'll be discussing causal structure, And to have this enormous speed of light is just a bit daft. I mean, I know that typically, when you do theoretical physics at PhD level and beyond, you forget you've even set C equal to 1. But it's worthwhile just remembering that, and remembering that the real reason you've set C equal to 1 is that you're considering usually highly relativistic situations. If you're looking at geodesics, for example, you want to think of light-like geodesics, which you'd like to be able to draw at 45 degrees, or very highly relativistic particles. For H-bar, at most of the time, why did I even mention it, right? Most of the time, we're not even going to be aware that H-bar exists for this course, because general relativity is very much a classical physics subject. It's deterministic. We're talking about definite predictions. We're talking about looking at systems of equations which directly relate to the reality, the physics that we're measuring, rather than anything probabilistic. But I do intend to discuss black hole thermodynamics. I want to talk a bit about black hole entropy, about the black hole temperature, and I'll give you a sort of simple way of calculating temperatures, rather than the real calculation, but one that in practice people use when they want to know the temperature of the space-time. And therefore, implicitly, there really is an H-bar for that particular part of the discussion. So, however, I want to keep G in, mainly because G sets dimensions. And if you set G equals 1 as well, then you've reduced yourself right down completely to the Planck scale, where you're measuring everything in terms of Planck time, Planck length, and Planck mass. And it's quite useful to just remember that physics is dimensionful, and so if there's a G there, it kind of just keeps you honest, and it just reminds you about what the dimensions of things are. So that's just a little bit of precursor about my choices and conventions. So let's just write down Einstein equations. This was what you derived with Neil, and to a large extent, what we're going to do is to discuss applications of these equations, some solutions, and extensions of the standard Einstein gravity beyond the normal cases. But before doing that, as I said, I wanted to do some revision. And the revision is really a bit more on the mathematics behind the equations, what you mean by curvature, and what you really mean by space-time, I guess. So let's look at a little bit of geometry. So in reality, when we talk about space-time, we're imagining something about everybody's got their own perspective on it, but I usually am imagining something tangible, and something a bit like your sort of rubber sheet that you often think about as an analog of curving space-time. But a manifold is what we think of, that's what we mean mathematically by space-time. So we kind of know what we mean by manifold intuitively, but if we want to think about it mathematically, we sort of imagine we have this object, which is like a set of points usually, which we're going to promote to events because we're in space-time. And so what's our physical quantity? It is something that happens at a particular time. So it's a sort of set of events. And by sort of thinking about a place and a time, I'm implicitly here introducing something which we call in the mathematical side, coordinates. So what you do to define your manifold forgot about this chalk, it always snaps for me, is that you're locally saying that a patch of your manifold can be mapped onto a copy of Rn, some flat sort of Cartesian space. So this mapping is what you would call your coordinates. So here's where I'm kind of abbreviating, but here. So we imagine our manifold to be covered by overlapping open sets, and each of these is a chart, and the whole set of charts is the atlas. So a really good example is just thinking of the Times Atlas of the world. That's an absolutely sort of very concrete visualization of what you mean by manifold. The manifold is the surface of the Earth in that case. Each open set is a particular page that you open in the book and corresponding to some particular part of the Earth. And what that's done is it's taken the real Earth that we live on, which is sort of quite a complicated and wrinkled space, and mapped it onto some plane sheet, an R squared, a little patch of R squared. And our coordinates, in that case, would be longitude and latitude. So that's a very easy way of visualizing what this formal definition is of a manifold. And then what you do when you want to define things on your manifold, what you invariably do is you pull them down into this little copy of R to the N, where you know how to do the operations such as differentiation, and that's how you end up defining things on your manifold. So what we do is we use easily here, or does it get a bit? Don't get too low. Okay. So we use these coordinate charts and this atlas to define quantities that we might want. So, for example, functions vectors, etc. We're always imagining this correspondence of taking ourselves from this abstract thing down to something that we know and can manipulate. So the only other thing that we tend to, there's a bit of definition, we're going to assume that on the overlap here, the difference between the different set of coordinates is well defined as a map, because our coordinates now live in R to the n and is differentiable. So this is just, I mean, you don't have to have infinitely differentiable, but I'd rather just state that up front, because I want to just be able to go ahead and differentiate and work with things like they're sort of nice and well behaved as I would want them to be. So let's just again remind ourselves what we mean by vectors and structure on the manifold. In order to define a vector, I need to have a concept of functions and curves first. So let me just, since I've actually taken the trouble to write it down. So let's just ask what we mean by a function, which is using this idea of transporting everything down to the underlying Rn. So a function is just something which is a number at every point. And so we say it's infinitely differentiable if on one of these patches we pop down to Rn and we just can differentiate with respect to the coordinates on Rn. It means infinitely differentiable. It's the sort of, it's the mathematical notation. So I didn't say that, did I? I sort of wrote it above. It's kind of, I think it's derived from the idea of things being continuous. So a function can be continuous, but its derivative isn't. Or a function can, and its derivative can be continuous, but the second derivative isn't. And that would be C1. It's sort of how many derivatives are continuous. So I think that's where it comes from. But it's kind of easier to write C infinity than infinitely differentiable, so that's why I did that. And so a curve, again, by the same token, is just where I can draw, you know, a line on my manifold, and that is going to correspond to a curve in Rn. So at the moment I'm still writing C infinity. At some point I'm going to forget and just always take it that everything is infinitely differentiable unless I say otherwise. So here is our curve. It's a map. So this is just taking a line or a part of a line, drawing it in the manifold. And again, we take some local chart we look at what happens if we map it onto our Rn, and then all of those, these are infinitely differentiable functions in Rn. So that's what our curve is. And then vectors are defined as tangents to curves. So was that does that sound familiar? Was that how you had a vector defined? Yes?
A curve is a map from R to M or M.
Well, it's a map from reals to the manifold, because what you're doing is you're taking, let's say, a little segment here where this is T, some number, and you're saying that here this is going into here, the set of points, set of events in your manifold. So it's mapping a bit of the real line into your manifold. So for example, let's think about the interval. Here's the real line. And here's an interval 0 to pi. Okay? Now, I could choose to map that onto r squared. I mean, in that case, that's obviously a manifold because it is r to the n. And I could say, well, my map here is going to be defined as a cos theta, a sine theta, where this is theta, is that real number. So that would then take me to the circle, and the circle is a curve on the plane. So you're making a line. I mean, there you're taking the real axis is just a line from our geometric manifold point of view, and you're taking usually some part of it, maybe not the whole of the reals, and putting it into your manifold. And then you take the coordinates, usually, to be, that's your sort of local representation in a chart. So another example, here, this is where you see it being a curve in a flat space. Another example, x mu of t could be the world line of an observer. That's another example. If you have an observer in your space-time, then, you know, they will trace out a line of events, which is everything that has ever happened to them. That's the curve. And so t then really would be time or something related to time. But it doesn't have to be. It could be something in space as well. But these are just examples of what this means. So here is something where it's sort of clear and geometric because you're mapping into something that's a very nice, friendly manifold. But in general, if you're imagining, well, gosh, this manifold isn't something that looks very neat and nice, it's a sort of messy universe, then you still just think of it as a world line and just think of that as your curve, because that's what it looks, you know, that's what it would mean. So then you define a vector basically as a tangent to a curve. So if you have this general curve here, So what this means is that I'm sort of saying here, this is sort of how I've written it in abstract. If you had a function then you can imagine going from your real line here for the curve, popping up into the manifold, its image, and then you imagine f of t as being the value of the function along that curve. So, I'm sorry this sounds very formal, I'm simply just trying to go, sort of refresh the ground, but do it from a little bit more of an abstract point of view. By using, you know, the structure of what you mean by the curve and what you mean by a function, you've now got something here, f of t, which is, it's almost as if it's forgotten about the manifold, but it hasn't quite. But it's something very familiar. It's a normal function. It's what you first meet when you first do calculus. And this is how you learn to differentiate. So you know how to differentiate this function f. So that's just df dt. But we're saying that df dt is, if we now think of f as our, in our manifold context, as a function on the manifold, it's the vector acting on the function. So vectors are maps from the, you know, from the set of functions into the set of functions. And this is what we do if we are looking for our derivative. We could write df dt here, where we've used the definition of gamma to pop up to the manifold and back down again. Or we could remember that there's a manifold there and say, well, if I want to find df dt, I can go through my coordinate functions and I take df dx mu, which I know I can, and then simply project them onto the tangent vector. So this would be, you know, an alternative way of looking at it. So this is actually how vectors are defined. They're defined in terms of tangents of curves, and as such, they're defined at a particular point. So a vector is something which is associated with a point in the manifold. Yes, I'm going to say, I'll come back to that because there's actually a little subtlety of that. It's from the purposes of practical working with gravity, those t mu are what we would call the components of a vector. But let me just finish with saying about the vectors and then I'll come back to it because there's a slight subtlety about that. So just hold for a minute. So, I've actually prejudged the fact that this is going to be a vector space by calling it a vector. But in fact, if you choose different curves, so here I could have chosen, if this is gamma 1, I could have chosen another curve coming across here, gamma 2, and I would get another vector. This could be t1 and t2. And so you build up different vectors by different curves. And if you change your parameterization, you change the length of the vector. If you whip along this curve twice as fast, your vector will be twice as long. So you see that these things form a vector space. So again, if you're interested in this stuff, you can sort of double check, you know, what you mean by a vector space and verify that the definitions are satisfied. And this is called the tangent space, a P. And then, of course, you can build up tangent spaces at every point of the manifold. And that's what's called the tangent bundle. So, again, an easy example to see is the two sphere, the surface of the Earth. If we think of our two sphere, we know it's got like two dimensions. And so what we're expecting is that that will be a two-dimensional manifold. So there's our two sphere. Let's draw a curve on it, a couple of curves at some general point. Sphere looks like a ball here. Okay, so what happens if you imagine all sorts of curves, let's say coming up to the North Pole, and you look at the tangent plane? The tangent plane around the sphere is simply a piece of flat paper, which is touching the sphere at that point. So the tangent space is R squared, the manifold is S2. And it's, in this case, which we visualize as just lying tangent to the sphere at that point. And then at each of the points on the sphere, we could imagine one of these sheets of paper, and that would be the tangent bundle. And so a lot of these phrases are really because when mathematicians were developing the concepts, they were thinking of S2 or curves, you know, just simple, you know, one-dimensional, say, submanifolds of R3. This is a two-dimensional one. So that's what these things are. Now, to return to the question, what I wrote down as T mu, that is, in the context that I wrote it down, is representing the components of the vector in a particular basis of this tangent space. So this thing is a vector space. So it has a basis. Okay? So we can think of, there are several natural bases that you could choose, but there's only really going to be two that I'm going to be interested in. So what I'd written before was T mu d by dx mu, which is what's called a coordinate basis. But if we have a concept of distances, like a dot product, we could also have a notion of length. And so you might see this written as well, okay? Where this is a fearbine in terms of R. So if we have a metric, we have a notion of length, we can choose our vectors to be, first of all, of unit length and mutually orthogonal. So in this in this case, we would have that EA dot EB would equal delta. Well, let me call eta AB, I suppose. Eta AB. I forgot there we weren't in normal. Basis, right? It's a basis vector. So I'll underline it here, actually. That's a good point, Colin. If I underline it, then it's obvious. Now, when I wrote, what you'll see, and I know I'll slip into this, it's like 19th century notation, but it's what's called abstract index notation. And it's really something that is, to some extent, a formality, and we can kind of forget about it. But it's one of the reasons why, if you sit in on pure mathematical courses in geometry, it can be a little bit jarring. And it's simply because in physics we use this t mu to represent the vector itself. In mathematics, T nu are the components of the vector in the coordinate basis. Okay. So T nu are a set of numbers, scalars. So this is called, and I don't know if it was Penrose who actually coined this phrase, but he wanted it to be formalized, what was going on, and it's called abstract index notation. But in essence, as long as you're aware that there is this alternative meaning, it will usually be clear by context what is meant by T nu. I will try and be honest, so in the sense that in this preliminary stage, when I'm going to be deriving a few, you know, re-deriving for you some of the basics of geometry, I will use the T nu in the mathematical sense. But as soon as we get on to actually doing gravitational physics, I'll quickly leave that behind, and I'll be using this abstract index notation. I'll mean the vector. So for this sort of preliminary stage, I'll try and remember to sort of keep saying it so that it's obvious. But it's usually fairly clear by context. If you see lots of things like, you know, underlined and form notation and very abstract geometric looking notation, then we're talking maths, okay? But, Yes, and that is exactly what they are in the physics-y sense, yeah. you could have any basis you wanted, right? But as far as we're concerned, the only ones that are really of any use, usually, are either coordinates or orthonormal. Mostly, I'm going to look at coordinate bases, But orthonormal bases are very useful when you have more complicated space-times. So quite a lot of space-times can have cross-terms, particularly if you're dealing with things like rotating black holes, for example, or some of the nastier manifolds that could crop up in string theory. Some of those have got some fairly none but the brave type of metrics. But in those cases, it's useful to have an orthonormal basis, because then you can separate off the difficulty in terms of the difficulty of the actual calculation you're trying to do and the complexity of this sort of metric, which may have cross terms. And so the orthonormal basis is useful for that. It's also useful if you're doing supersymmetry, or even just not supersymmetry, but thinking about fermions in space-time, because if you want to describe fermions, you know that you have the Dirac equation, and therefore you've got Dirac matrices. But remember, your Dirac matrices obey these, you know, you've got the fact, you've got these anti-commutation relations, which take you to eta mu nu. But of course, you've probably only done them in flat space. What happens when your manifold's curved? When your manifold is curved, what you have to do is take your Dirac matrices and flip them using this coordinate transformation. In essence, you've got your rigid, you know, your nice plus one, minus one, etc., Dirac basis. And then you have to use the orthonormal basis to contract with your Dirac matrices, in order that your anti-commutation relations work. So those are the sort of obvious cases where you want to use an orthonormal basis. But actually, I'll also be using orthonormal bases in calculating curvatures as well. So they are useful, but in practice, most of the time, and certainly in the context of what we'll be talking about, when you write down metrics, you write them down in a coordinate basis, because it's somehow easier to interpret or to see what goes on. So that's the sort of basics of vectors. Just to remind you then about covectors. Again, what's the mathematical definition of these things? So a covector takes a vector and gives you a number. So here, I use a sort of Brahn-Ket notation. Again, it's this geometrical notation. And this is saying a covector is simply a map from your vector space to the reals. So it sort of turns everything upside down. You thought of vectors as being something where the length and direction, vectors come to be defined from maps, from the reals to the manifold, or rather from functions to functions. And covectors are now mapped from vectors down into the reals. And what you're sort of thinking of here is like, it would be, it's a bit, think of them as a bit like a dot product, but I shouldn't say that, because that implies that you've got a metric. But here you might have U alpha d by dx. Alpha would be your coordinate basis, and this would be omega beta dx beta. So these would be the expressions in terms of these coordinate bases. So for any basis, of a tangent space, there's an obvious dual basis . So this is the cotangent space TP star, and it's simply the dual basis to the normal basis. So I think if you've done anything with lattices and basis vectors of lattices, then you may have done a dual basis for your lattice. So it's the same thing, it's the same concept. If you haven't, don't worry. The definition is that omega A EB is delta AB. So it's, again, if you had a metric, you would think of this as somehow carrying information. But you don't need a metric for this at all. This is just talking about maps in general. There's always a cotangent space, whether or not you've got a metric. And so if I use this context here, omega and u would then be omega beta u alpha, dx beta d by dx alpha. This would give me delta alpha beta. And so you'd simply just multiply together the individual components and add them up. It's exactly like a dot product, except it isn't really a dot product. So you may also see the omegas written as E, as an E with the index upstairs. And in fact, that's mostly how you'll see it in supersymmetry or supergravity. I use omega partly because it's what I'm used to, and I think it also reminds me that it is the cotangent and not a tangent vector or a tangent basis. So, you know, but just so that you're aware that there's another convention there. And so then you build up tensor products by simply sort of taking combinations of T and T star elements. So you simply take the tensor product of these spaces. So we've introduced functions, vectors, covectors. Normally, and I've already talked about differentiation in the context of functions, but normally we want to be able to differentiate anything physical, because physics is usually about trying to determine how things change, and to determine how things change, you need differential equations. In order to have differential equations, you've got to be able to differentiate. So we need, and this is one of the real not challenges, but this is where you really begin to see things that you need coming from this theory, you know, the mathematical theories. We need to know how to differentiate vectors, and this is where you start to see things getting more complicated. This is where things differ between the manifold, this curved space, and R to the n, the flat space. So normally when we differentiate, we would say that df by dt, so let's just remind ourselves, this is what we would do if we're dealing with a function where we knew what we were doing. We'd look at where we wanted to take our derivative, t naught. We'd go a little bit further past it by h. We compare the value of f there with the value of f where we are, divide by h, and then take a limit as h goes to naught. So that gives us the gradient. So why can't we do that here? Well, we can if it's a function, because we just did it. That's how we defined the vector. But let's imagine we wanted to do this for a vector. So let's think about what the challenges are. So we're thinking we've got... So first of all, what do we mean by thinking about vectors, you know, on the manifold? So we imagine that we have something which is a sort of vector, what we call a vector field, which is a vector at every point of the manifold. So what we really mean there, actually, is it's a vector which lies in the tangent space at each point on the manifold, okay? So the first thing, first sort of challenge that we have, is the fact that V is in TP of M, which is a different vector space if we move to a different point. So that's our first challenge. How are we going to compare vectors at different points? And then, of course, we might wonder, what does H mean? Okay. So that's another challenge. How would we say, you know, we're moving away from P? Well, the second one is perhaps easier to tackle because you could think, well, hang on, I've got a vector space at P, I've got all these different directions I can go along, so I simply have, you know, some vectorial type of derivative. But it still doesn't take us away from this problem here. So as you saw when you did your relativity course, by thinking about these issues, you actually are led to ways of differentiating your vectors. So, the first one is, as in, what is H? Thinking about how you move along or different ways, that leads to an idea of something called a Lie derivative. A Lie derivative is where we move along, our H is defined by another vector field. We also have our covariant derivative, which is what you would have had emphasized, which is thinking about linking vector spaces at different points. And then another derivative, is again thinking about H to some extent. It's thinking about how you move along, move away from where you are, but you kind of do it in such a way that sort of you don't care about how the things link together. It's not quite you don't care, but the bit by which this causes you trouble gets cancelled off. Now, can I just check, you presumably they only did covariant derivative, right? Okay, so you know what that is. Exterior derivative is about, takes you to forms, so this is like an anti-symmetric derivative. And the Lie derivative is nice because it reveals some of the algebraic structure of the space-time. So just to wrap up, I've kind of refreshed mostly stuff you've already known about and done, but perhaps just from a slightly different perspective. And, you know, reminded ourselves of what vectors are and maybe just made it a little bit more formal. And just finishing off by setting up the sort of challenge about differentiating on manifolds. So in the next lecture, we'll come back to that. We'll talk about Lie derivative, exterior derivative, and forms. The good thing about Lie derivative also tells you about symmetries, and symmetries are really, really important when you're doing practical gravity. And so, and from this, we'll then just remind ourselves about curvature, and I'll talk a bit about using some of this formalism to give you a sort of easy way of calculating curvature, which is called Cartan's structural equations. So, any questions? I know I've had a few on the way, but any more? Was it sufficiently different from Neil? Yeah. Okay.
What if you had a manifold with a boundary? How would you talk about that?
Okay, well, you always ask these leading questions, Colin, don't you? We will be talking about manifolds with boundaries. So at the moment, I've really just been thinking about our manifold as either being something which is closed, like the S2, or something which is infinite, like our universe. But it is possible to have manifolds with a boundary, and this introduces sort of yet more joy, yet more structure, and yet more formalism. And as we'll be seeing when we do this, Einstein's equations are very unusual in terms of sort of physics equations because they're derived from a Lagrangian which has second derivatives of the metric in it. Normally, your kinetic terms in the Lagrangian are first derivatives of the metric, so that when you do a variational problem, you sit by saying your function is invariant on the boundary, that's good enough, because it's just a first derivative in your Lagrangian. Trouble with Einstein's equations is it's second derivatives, so you have to worry about first derivatives. When you do the Einstein equations, you have to set the first derivative to zero. Doing boundaries properly removes that need, but it introduces extra dynamics of the boundary. And that's useful because in string theory you have brains, which are boundaries in a sense, they're where open strings end. And so this formalism in part can help with dealing with brains, and it's also being used in terms of actually thinking about when our universe might actually have an end. So, yeah.
My question was really, how do you recognize a boundary?
How do you recognize a boundary? Right, well, but it's the same as the difference between an open set and a closed set. So, you know, in terms of an open set, you can always squeeze a neighborhood in which lies entirely within your manifold. A boundary, you can't. So that's your closed. Okay.